This is the Athletic Baseball Show on the Athletic Podcast Network.
First of all, I just want to thank everybody for coming out here. I know what Eno just said, we're going to have Q&A after, but come up forward. I would love to mix you all in asking questions so I'm not talking and asking questions the whole time. This is all about you all and your subscribers. We appreciate it so much. So if you have a question to ask anybody on the panel, work your way up and we'll get you in there. And so I got to start, I think, with the obvious question.
Oh, wait, really quickly.
Oh, yeah.
Thanks, other half. Thanks to Ryan McLaughlin for making that sandwich out there. Thanks to James. What up, James?
Anybody else, Eno? You want to?
Steve.
Thank you, Steve.
Yes, this is Steve on audio. All right, we got to talk about the rule changes. So, Ken, let's start with you. When you look at all the difference in the game now, where do you see the biggest impact, immediately?
I don't know that I would choose one thing. I do think the shift is going to matter. But the stolen base thing is, to me, perhaps where we're going to see the biggest impact. Because the bases are bigger. The disengagement rule is a real thing. You've got two, and that's it. And you're going to see, I would expect, a significant increase in stolen bases this year.
Yeah. What about you, when you look at...
It's one of those things that I think on a player-to-player level, it might be boring and we may not see that many hits. Like, a player might get five more hits and that's not going to be that big deal. But if you add five hits to every player, I think the shift thing is going to be the biggest difference. We're going to see the biggest batting average on balls in play that we've maybe ever seen. Early spring indications are we're going to have a BABIP around 305 or 310. We haven't had that, I think, ever. So that's going to be an interesting thing to watch, I think, is just how that happens. Because it may not be that one player hits 380 or 400 or whatever, but we might see every player hit that many points higher.
Tim?
Yeah, I mean, I think the pitch clock will be what registers most with fans. But I'm with Ken that the disengagements rule, and I hate that we have to call them disengagements all the time. It's such a ridiculous word. But I think that's what's going to impact the most strategically and how pitchers operate, whether it's they don't throw over at all like John Lester or whether they're willing to throw that third time. I know the Mets have talked about that. It's important to show that you'll throw a third time just to let teams know. So
Tim, I'd be curious, what are the players complaining the most about? When there's rule changes, that's the first thing you get the gripes. What are you hearing in the room?
So I cover Max Scherzer. So he's been all about the pitch clock. I mean, he was talking with a group and Jason Stark, and Jason wrote about it just last week, about how he's cognizant of the pitch clock 100% of the time and is looking for ways to exploit it. Wants it turned off if they're at the right pace so that games aren't decided by it. But I think that's what's the hardest for guys to get used to. I think, throwing over a third time, they'll get used to that over time, but I think that's what bothers them the most.
Yeah.
You know what I would say, actually, Max is an exception. He's one of the most thoughtful players, and he's always got thoughts, put it that way. But most of the players are on board with this, and they might have some different thoughts on different things, but the left-handed sluggers, they are all for shift restrictions. And in general, the pitchers are okay too. And they're adjusting. And I went to the Yankee game today. There were really no incidents at all. I think there was one called strike on a hitter. But the game flowed. It was better. I think the players want to get out of there a little earlier too, get off their feet. And they're on their feet so much during games. So by and large, players seem pretty receptive.
That's great.
I think one thing that's funny is the players have such a high opinion of themselves that it comes through when you talk about it. Like, oh yeah, of course I can handle a pitch clock, or like pitchers never really like the shift because they're always like they always just remember the time when like, oh man, there used to be a defender there.
It sucks.
Screw the shift, So they're like, yeah, get rid of the shift. Yeah, I never liked it anyway. I can pitch. What are you talking about? I don't need a shift. So I think the funniest thing is that fans are complaining a lot more than the players. The players are like, yeah, whatever, tell me the rules, I'll win.
All right, what's your name first?
Daniel, first name.
Last name, Noel. Thank you, yeah.
I have a question for Eno, with respect to your recent tap into like command and stuff, and kind of like making that more of a scientific analysis versus a subjective one, right? So assessing how pitchers, the stuff that they have, quote unquote, right? How does that actually translate to results? So my question to you is, was your command stat more born out of like a long form take on how pitchers can like hit their spots, or was it because recent data allows you to access that information, here's where I want to create a new stat? So I'm curious like your long form like realization of that command view, because I find that particular stat very fascinating.
I used to have a stat called Command Plus, and that really tried to they used stringers to try and like, oh, he's trying to hit this spot, and this is how much he missed it by. And when we studied that, we found it had no predictive value. Cal Bode will say things like, "Command doesn't matter. There is no such thing as command." I step back from the brink a little bit, but just generally. I think that pitchers do not have as much command as we thought. There's more spread, and there's not that much spread in the true talent. Mostly pitchers should just throw it in the middle of the zone with good stuff, and their stuff will bring it to the good locations. And so the study of command is maybe in its infancy still, because we haven't proven it matters. And yet, everybody in baseball tells us it matters. So there's a disconnect there between what the numbers say and what people say. And I'm uncomfortable saying things like, command doesn't exist and command doesn't matter. But statistically, what we have now suggests that command doesn't exist and command doesn't matter.
Same question to Tim. All right, if anyone else has a question, let's keep them rolling here. What's your name, sir?
Pete.
All right, Pete.
So follow on to the rules question, is there one rule that you think might have gone too far, and anything that you would see like getting scaled back next year? Obviously, like they've been trying to prove it out in the minor leagues before bringing it into the majors. But is there anything that you think like in the way that they brought it to the majors that you see changing like next year, say, or in the middle of the year? I know like they changed the sticky stuff enforcement ban in the middle of the year. So anything like mid-year maybe or next year that you think could change?
Good question.
I'll go first. The clock to me might be a little quick. Now, I don't know that they're going to change it, but somebody suggested to me yesterday, well, what if it was 20 and 25 instead of 15 and 20? The game would still move. Now, watching the game today, it seemed pretty natural. No one was forced. My concern is as we get deeper into the season, September pennant race games, and especially postseason games, because if you go back and look at the Harper at bat, with Suarez in the NLCS last year, that is Violation City. But the drama of that built because Harper was stepping out, Suarez was stepping off. It was what you want from the playoffs. So I don't know if they'll relax it, because maybe by then everybody will be so used to it, it's okay, and that's just the way it's going to be. But that's the one concern I have. Ninth inning, even in an April game, ninth inning, maybe you slow it down a little bit, but I know what baseball is thinking. They're thinking, we're not giving an inch here, because the players, as we've seen, the reason we're here is because the players, if you give them an inch, they will take a mile. So we'll start here, see how it goes, but my concern is that.
Has anyone at The Athletic written about that Harper at bat lately?
Yeah. How about that story? Yeah. That was one of our best stories. Matt Gell. Yeah.
I mean, the counterpoint is all those Pedro Baez at-bats in the playoffs over the last couple of years.
I stand corrected.
I actually think the one thing that might change would be, and Jason has written about this as with all the rule changes, is whether like the two-man outfield shift eventually gets banned if they decide, basically go farther with the shift rather than the spirit of your question. But if they decide, you know, if more teams do that during the regular season than we've seen in spring training, and they decide that that's not kosher. You know, you have any thoughts on that?
I just don't. I don't want us to draw circles in the outfield.
The wedge.
Jason Stark wrote about that one. That would actually, the wedge would be the most effective. The wedge is this idea that let's say you take the first baseline, the baseline from first to second, and you extend it out to the outfield, and you pass second base, and then you take the baseline from third to second, you extend it out, you create a pizza slice back there, and that no defender could stand in that pizza slice behind second base. That would actually be the most effective way to bring singles back into the game. That would be the most effective way. And I coach Little League, and like, we tell everybody in Little League, hit it up the middle, you know? And I think almost every coaching spot along the way, hitting up the middle is good. And even now with this shift restriction, hitting up the middle is not that great. There's still that shortstop that can stand like basically on second base and steal that hit up the middle. So, but I don't like it either. Like I don't want to see extra lines drawn on the pitch. Yeah, I don't like it.
I want to play for Eno's Little League team for sure. All right, we got another question. What's your name?
Asher.
Sure, go ahead.
All right, I'm glad we talked about Command Plus. Throw out any stat with a plus in it. You throw out most of the other stats. Who are you most excited to watch this season?
Oh, I thought you were just saying throw them out. I was like,
yeah, just get rid of it. Pure vibes, baseball. Pure vibes, just for the... Who are you most excited to watch this season?
Ron Acuña Jr.
You know what? That would have been my answer, too.
No, sorry. Sorry, I had to blurt it out.
That's a great answer, though.
I mean, I just think he's healthy again, and I think he's a supreme athletic talent that has got his wind under him again. I'm excited to see if someone actually can go 50-50. I had a job once where I was working in the bullpen at MLB.com, and that you edit all the pieces that go up on MLB.com. And in my first day in the bullpen, I had to edit three stories about how Matt Kemp wanted to go 50-50. And the whole time I was like, this dude is not going 50-50. Why are we writing about this? We got really three stories about this? But if somebody could go 50-50, could be Ronald Acuña Jr. I don't know. He's that kind of talent.
Because I cover the Mets, I'll have to go with a Met and not one of their chief rivals. I've been fortunate to cover a lot of really good pitchers in my career, but now getting to see Verlander up close will be a lot of fun to see what makes him as good a pitcher of his generation as anyone else. Once he's back in 5 months.
Groans.
I'll go with two young guys. Volpe, who was very impressive today. The walk-off Logan Webb, his first plate appearance, he laid off some pretty good pitches. And in a moment where you would have thought he'd be jumping out of his brain, right? Yeah. So that was impressive. And also Orioles' Gunnar Henderson. That guy's a talented dude, and I'm really excited to see him play.
Any more questions coming? All right. What's your name?
Ben. I was wondering, do you guys have any ideas like what the new frontiers will be with bat tracking?
You
know,
that's all you.
No, it isn't.
Bad tracking.
Yeah, well, you had that great bad fitting. That's part of it.
It's true. But you go first.
Well, the Hawkeye is going to give us a lot in the future. Right now, it's in its infancy. So Hawkeye is in its third year, and PitchFX, when it was in its third year, it had a hard time differentiating between pitch types and sinkers and four seamers, and so we're at the beginning, but eventually it'll be able to tell your different body parts. It can't quite yet. It has a hard time with the pelvis, which some men do, and so it can't tell exactly what your pelvis is doing, and sometimes it has a hard time telling where your hand ends and where the bat begins. But the end of the bat.
Are we still talking about baseball? You know? My goodness.
But it is now tracking pretty well the velocity of the bat head. And so there was some fun stuff last year from MLB AM where it had bat speed. And now there's all these arguments about where should we measure the bat speed, where along the bat, and we'll have those arguments, we'll figure it out, and eventually we'll be able to separate out bat speed as a skill that certain players have. Now that's going to be separate from how good you are at centering the ball. And then on top of that, as we measure these things better, we can fit bats better, we can do certain things like that. And you had a great story about the bat fitting.
Right, I went to Baton Rouge to see the Marucci lab that a lot of big-time players are going to get fitted for bats, like golfers are fitted for golf clubs. It's very common in golf. I'm not a golfer, I didn't know about that. But it was fascinating to see. And when I'm sitting there watching them take Austin Riley, it was, through this whole process, they wired him up, motion capture, the whole deal. I'm sitting there thinking, I'm not really seeing how this works, but there is definitely a science to it, and it was really interesting. And Goldschmidt and Arenado, they were two of the first guys to go last year. They swear by it. And Alonso on the Mets is trying one too, even though he's not a Marucci guy. But it'll be interesting to see how he feels about it as we go along. It's really something what they can do to measure things now that we didn't measure before. We're even, you know, I would say 10 years ago, we're leaps and bounds beyond where we were then. And it's...
And give us another 10 years.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that's tough about all this is, like, I went to Driveline and put the green balls on. I had to take my shirt off, and they're gluing balls all over me. And, like, again, are we talking about baseball? But the reason that I was doing that, it was like when you make a video game, Gollum had the green balls all over him, and that's how they made Gollum. But I have to do all that because our technology is not quite to the point where it can tell my different limbs apart, and so it needs these markers. But the next generation of stuff is going to be, it's called markerless motion capture. That's what Hawkeye does, that's what a thing called Kinetrax does, and that's what teams are investing in. And they have right now a big decision about sticking with Hawkeye and waiting for that to get really good, or some of the stuff like Kinetrax that's a little bit further along, a little bit better right now. So teams like the Twins have gone heavy into Kinetrax. Teams like the Astros are heavy into Kinetrax. Other teams are relying on Hawkeye and waiting for Hawkeye to sort of figure it all out.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
All right, we got another question. What's your name?
My name is Jason. How you doing, guys? Thanks for being here. I had a question about some of the contracts we saw this offseason, but more specifically, you know, with these guys, I mean, this is a year-round job, right? Health and performance and training and nutrition and all this kind of stuff. Do you think that the sort of evolution of that gives some of these contracts a bit more runway where some of these guys will last a little bit longer in their careers, and these contracts maybe won't look as bad as these same type of contracts looked even maybe 3 or 4 years ago?
That is a really good question. And in fact, judges' agents made that point in their negotiations with different teams, that players today train differently. They are much more aware of nutrition. They are much more capable of lasting longer.
Not partying as much.
They're not partying as much. They're in their room playing video games. So. Will this actually transpire where guys are productive in their late 30s into their 40s? I'm not so sure. But it is an argument that can be made, and we'll see how it plays out. Certainly, all of the things that are happening that players are endeavoring in, training, all these different things, they all matter and they all are meaningful, but I don't know that you can slow the aging curve that much.
Tim, I got a question for you in regards to this. Like, you've done a lot of work with contracts, and you've got sort of like an algorithm or a process that you go through in order to kind of judge these contracts. You know, one of the questions that we had on this one was, you know, if you had to pick one of the 10, 11-year contracts, the Corey Seager, Treya Turner, Xander Bogaerts deals, does some of them look better in your process? Did you predict any of them to be that big? What do you think about the 10-year deals in regards to your process?
No, I mean, like, my process is basically looking at comparable players.
Right.
So you're not used to seeing guys sign through age 40 outside
right.
of, I think, Miguel Cabrera,
right.
Which was not a deal that aged well. So I think, you know, I believe Seager is not signed that long.
Right.
Like, it's a 10-year deal, but it doesn't take him into his 40s at all the way it does with Turner and Bogaerts. So you would say kind of naturally that would be the one you favor. But also I think Turner and Bogaerts have been better players to this point. And so Turner's actually...
The athleticism is very different from one to the other.
Yeah, and Turner is, he's one of those guys, his birthday's like late June. And so what's his age 30 season is not the same as someone else. Like Bogaerts, they're both in their age 30 season. Bogaerts is 10 months older than him or something like that. I think... For that, for the athleticism, you probably take Turner just overall. Although, you know, Bogaerts, you can imagine him being the Michael Brantley of a team when he's 39.
That's the only
right?
thing I was going to say.
Like, you can see, that skill set seems like it'll still be there to be an effective player.
With the three guys, with Turner, you have the athleticism, the speed, right? The versatility. Like, he could be your center fielder for a while, and then your left fielder, and defensively he'll play. Bogaerts has the hit tool. Of the three, he has the hit tool. And I almost think that might age the best. Like, you could see a 40-year-old guy going out there hitting 280 with 16 homers and still being valuable even at DH, right? And Seager's skill set almost seems like the old man skill set, the sort of power and patience skill set. But you could also see that guy DHing, where he's just taking walks and hitting 30 homers. And so I could see an argument for all three, and I'm not actually that decisive. You might know that I'm not that decisive, and I hem and haw. I'm the king of waffles.
Keep in mind, too, none of the teams expect that these guys are going to be productive at the end of the contract. They know what they're doing. This was done to lower the luxury tax hit in each case. So it will be interesting to see which one does the best. But if you ask the teams, they would say, whatever. You know, we know they're not going to be great.
Last 3 years are going to suck. It's going to be fine. Well, I think that's really interesting, like, in the context of the Padres. It's like, well, last 3 years are going to suck for all three of them. Oh, nice. That's going to be real awesome.
As someone who came from Detroit, though, the Miguel Cabrera slander will not stand for it. I think that contract's been great.
The first contract was great.
The first one. We're talking about the first one.
Yeah.
All right, we got another question here. What's your name?
Harrison. This question is for Tim. Ryan Mauricio had a great spring training. What do you see his future looking like with the Mets?
Is that Ronnie Mauricio?
Yeah, his future with the Mets.
I mean, I'm really intrigued by what they do with him defensively this year, because he's starting the year at shortstop. That's clearly not where his future is in the Mets organization. The next spot you would move him to is third base, but you're also trying Beatty there. And it's kind of this weird thing where they're both on the same kind of parallel track where, you know, you kind of want one to play third and one to play left field. Beatty's a little closer to play third. Which one do you move to left field first?
And you just signed a second baseman, too.
Yeah, and you have McNeil there for a while, but McNeil can move to left field, too, if you wanted. So I think, you know, Mauricio, the way he hit the ball, not just in spring training, but in winter ball, makes you think that there's a lot in there. As long as he's good enough at pitch recognition, he's not going to be a guy who runs a 350 on base percentage probably ever in the major leagues, but can he be a 320 OBP guy who hits 30 home runs for you while playing third base? It's a really useful player. I don't think his ceiling is as high as it is for Beatty or for Alvarez, but it is probably as an everyday player on a pretty good team.
Some of this is why some teams like the Giants require all of their players to play like three positions. So they just to sort of get out in front of this, they had even like Joey Bart that was coming up, they had him playing first. There was no way he was ever really going to be a first baseman. The bat wasn't going to carry there. But it just prepared everybody to be like, okay, I'm in the Giants organization. I have to play through three. I have to have three gloves, you know. I have to get used to this. And kind of helps you get out in front of that.
Yeah, like I talked to GMs this spring about, like, you know, when in a player's development do you, when he looks like he's blocked at the major leagues, do you move him to another position? And they all said, like, well, we just kind of start that versatility thing in high A now. And the Mets have not done that. So I'm waiting for when they make that waiting for when they make that decision, because it's a little tougher with him in Syracuse now.
All right, this next question comes in remotely. If we were to remove Ohtani, Judge, Soto, and Betts from the equation, who is your MVP to pick this year? We'll start with Eno.
Well, I had the Acuna answer earlier, but I'm gonna go with Mike Trout.
And you can't use Acuna.
What?
Acuna's out as well.
Oh, he's out as well. Okay. I'm gonna go with Mike Trout, and I stole this. From Ian Kahn, who I love. But Mike Trout spent all of the WBC talking to you afterwards. He said the word fun like 8 million times. Funnest. And then he gave another interview where he said, I'm going to do everything I can to keep Shohei Ohtani in Anaheim. He also hit 44 homers in like 400 plate appearances last year. So I could see him coming out and leading the league, 55 homers, 300, you know, batting average, and just being like, hey, Shohei, I can be an MVP too. Two MVPs, and the Angels will still win 82 games.
A good season for them. I'd probably go with Trey Turner, because in that ballpark he's going to hit more home runs, which MVP voters still like to an extent. And I think anytime a guy goes to a new team, like, the impact he makes on it becomes more pronounced, because you have this comparison to what the team was like, especially a team that did not have a good leadoff hitter last year, and what he can do to that offense. Seems like he could stand out even more.
I'll go with Arenado, simply because he's been a top five guy several times. I'm not exactly sure how many, but it's multiple. And it almost seems like maybe it's his time.
All right, we got a couple more here.
Yeah, so I'm Sam. And I'm a Reds fan, so if you were to just spontaneously talk about the Reds, that's fine. Despite the giggles. But the actual question is about expansion. You know, they talked about at least four sites moving some teams. Do you really Nashville doesn't seem real to me. Charlotte doesn't seem real to me. I would say Montreal and Vegas, but do you guys have thoughts on that? And what would happen, you know, in the future of, are they going to actually expand to so many teams?
I'm talking about Grand Nashville.
Actually, Nashville does seem real to me. And I know the one major obstacle might be proximity to Cincinnati, Atlanta, St. Louis. Each of those teams has fans in Nashville, and they would scream. But that is a booming city. And they've got a group there that is quite organized, and it seems to me they're ready to go. Now, as you've heard for many years from our commissioner, we need to resolve Tampa Bay and Oakland first. In my view, Oakland will be in Vegas. And this is just my opinion. I don't see it happening there. And Tampa Bay maybe will get a stadium. So then where do you go? Portland to me seems too small. But I don't know, Charlotte is another city that...
Charlotte is booming. It's growing.
It's a booming place.
It's growing.
You go to Charlotte and Nashville, though, I would doubt that.
That's too close.
It's too close, and it's too east. I think we need to balance it. But I do believe Nashville's real. Never.
Can we make a Montreal case? Because that's the best city in the summertime to go to. It's unbelievable.
I believe it. One reason, there's reason to doubt it, there's reason to say, oh, these other things have to happen first, and I believe those things. However, I think there's actually something happening right now in baseball that could lead to the owners wanting to expand quickly. This Bally's thing is really bad. And with the Bally's thing, I think baseball can come out on the other side with a streaming solution like MLS, where you can just buy your team's games from, you know, directly from the supplier, and cut out the middleman, and baseball might come out the other end making more money than they did paying Bally's and doing that whole thing and paying the RSNs. However, in the meantime, they're going to lose money. And that loss comes at a time where they just spent a ton of money. And I think about the Rangers got out of their Bally's deal. So they don't have like a TV deal. They're going to be scrambling to like create a way for people to watch Rangers games. And the Rangers owner who just spent $1 billion on players might be like, oh yeah, you know what? Expansion means expansion fees. And expansion fees means I get $50 million or I get $100 million. And I think that sounds pretty good right now while I'm trying to build out my own TV network and make this thing work. So there might just be this kind of like short-term opportunity that leverages into expansion, even regardless of what happens with the A's and Rays. I don't know. It's just, I've been looking at that, and I think the Bally's thing is just really fascinating.
All right, we got...
It's super scary. They don't want to talk about it.
So
Manfred always looks super uncomfortable when like you ask him about it.
Yeah. All right, we got time for two more questions before we're going to do a line change on the panel. So we got one. What's your name?
Hey, I'm TJ. Thank y'all for coming out. Listen to all you guys. Appreciate it. This one's a little tilted toward Eno. From a fantasy perspective, I think about if MLB front offices are thinking so deeply about catchers and pitch framing and how that affects the results of their pitchers, should we be as fantasy players thinking about free agency acquisitions or trades and the impact that might have on pitchers and their K to walk ratio and those questions and how from an analytical perspective might we go about that?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I don't think I do it enough myself, but I do think you should look at how good a framer is on a team, and if, especially for a player that's moving teams. If you've got a guy who's being signed, like a Rodon, if he's going from the Giants to the Yankees, you have to think a little bit about, like, is Trevino a great framer? He was last year, he wasn't before. So there's, like, then you might have to project his framing ability, which is not easy. But let's say you just assume Trevino is a good framer, that will have some effect on Rodon. That'll have some effect on players that come to the team. So I think that's an important. I also think, and this is a real baseball sort of corollary, I think we've seen that I don't think that we're going to get automatic balls and strikes anymore. I don't think we're going to get robo-umps. I think what we're hearing is we're going to get a challenge system. And so there's going to be a certain amount of... I don't want that sound to come back. There's going to be a certain amount of challenges, and I think that's what's been going on in the minors, right?
Evan wrote this today, Evan Drellick, and Manfred spoke yesterday about this, how it seems to him, because the union objects to a whole subset of players being eliminated, the good framing catcher, that the solution might be the challenge system in which you get three challenges per game rather than every pitch being on ABS, which actually to me is more appealing with the challenges because it does include the human element. We can still yell at Angel and whoever else we want to yell at. And
yelling is fun.
Yeah, exactly. And it would still include this art form of framing that has really come on in recent years. It's always been there, but Evan can talk about that when he's up here, but it's something that Manfred addressed yesterday in more detail than he has before. And it seemed to me that he was ruling out every pitch. He wanted the challenge.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's the little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Visit DirecTV.com. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
All right, here's the final question. This better be really good. No pressure. Here we go.
Well, this one is specifically made for, you know.
Sorry.
As most of them have been.
But so this is a question about baseball on an international scale. I know that you have a bit of an international background. Shout out that sandwich. It was awesome.
Thank you.
But, like, looking at this past World Baseball Classic and how awesome it was and, like, that super underdog story of, like, the Czech Republic team, do you think as – baseball has always been an international sport, but as the World Baseball Classic grows, do you think we're going to start seeing players from countries we've never seen before? Like, what? Because you've lived in Europe before. What's your perspective on the growth in that?
Yeah, I did a story with Dovidas Neverauskas and Chili Davis and a whole bunch of people that came from countries, even Tyler O'Neill, Canada, and they came from countries that don't have that background. And there were two stories that emerged. One was I came to America, and this is my story. I came to America, and I wanted to be American, and so baseball, right? But that's not the only story. The other story I heard from somebody like Dovidas Novorauskas was somebody went to America or saw baseball and came back. And in my own community, I started playing baseball because they brought baseball back. And so that's, I think, what the hope of the WBC is that all these countries saw their own guys on TV, you know? And somebody from the Czech Republic might play baseball next year that never thought of playing baseball ever before. And so I think we are going to see that growth. And I just thought it was a lot of fun. I mean, just to open this up to you guys, like the WBC, like that was meaningful, right? Do you think that was meaningful we're talking about growing the game. Like, but we watched, the most people watching it was Japan and America. But like still, did you get the feeling that it's gonna grow the game beyond those countries?
Yes, and I'll use Great Britain as an example because they had a pretty good run. Surprising one. No one thought they would win a game. And their manager was very adamant about how this is going to be meaningful for them, funding, and just in general, kids over there recognizing, hey, this is the thing. So it might not be this mushroom big thing right away, but over time in different countries, there's no question that the WBC is going to help.
You know, the Great Britain needs more funding. You saw those jerseys.
Actually, Peter, that's no lie. Because I think the teams did pay for their own uniforms.
It looked like that, yeah.
So, yeah, you saw the jerseys. The letters falling off pretty bad.
It'll be all right, though. I mean, funding is the big thing. Funding is the big thing. You need to have national structure. It's a little bit of why certain countries are great at soccer. You know, it's like they have these academies and they funnel players into them and they have funding. I mean, like, Germans aren't naturally great at soccer. I mean, I don't look at a German and be like, oh yeah, that guy's gonna be good at soccer. I don't know. I'm a German, so I'm allowed to make jokes like this.
Me too. We hired them to be our World Cup team 8 years ago, I thought.
That's right. That's right. And so Germany just has great academies, great funding. If you're good at soccer, you're immediately put on like a travel team. They fund it for you. You don't have to pay for it. And so, you know, I think that funding is going to be a big deal. And so does Great Britain automatically get more funding for having gone further?
I'm not sure how that works, but they automatically qualify
right.
for next tournament. So
more people
that
alone
will help them. Yeah, and it just seemed that they were adamant about this, that, hey, our success here is going to be meaningful. And that was just one country. So I would expect that for others as well, the Czech Republic is a great example. It would be a good thing.
And I discovered something I didn't know. The WBC is owned collectively by the MLBPA and baseball. And that's why they were both so happy about it. It made a ton of money. There were a ton of people watching. And that's why it's going to happen again. Because it's something they can do together. It was the only time you see Tony and Manfred smiling and giving high fives with the WBC. So it's definitely going to happen again. And money is part of the reason why.
Awesome. And not the hog, just going off the Great Britain thing, MLB The Show including World Baseball Classic cards is one of the greatest things because Harry Ford is now one of my favorite players. He hits tanks. And then someone behind me in the crowd, they asked, you know, if you could expand upon your experience outside of the U.S.
I was born in Jamaica. I didn't see any baseball there. I went to Germany. My mom married an American. When I was in Germany, we would play baseball, and the local German kids would be like, what the hell is this? And what are you doing? Hamburg. We were in Hamburg. And then I came to Atlanta in 86, and I was doing a lot of Julio Franco and Gary Sheffield. So I played a lot of stickball after that. But yeah, the funniest was I do remember in Germany, me and my dad like taking a bunch of equipment to a field and just starting to play and people coming over. That's part of what happens at WC, right? It's like, what is this? I never heard of this. And then they come over and they play and like, this is okay.
All right, well, thank you guys for doing it. Let's give it up for these guys for coming up. And,